I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is going to be Ocean Vuong, a best-selling poet, and we're going to talk about his first and so far only book, Night Sky with Exit Wounds. He's an amazingly young, brilliant poet currently living in New York. I have today in the studio a friend of mine. He's a graduate student in our MFA program, our residential MFA program. He's actually from El Paso. His name is Aldo Amparan, and he's going to join us. Aldo, say hi.
Hi, everyone.
Aldo is, I said, a poet, right? You write poetry?
I write both poetry and fiction.
Oh, but you are more of a poet or more of a fiction writer?
Couldn't choose.
Oh my God, Aldo, I thought I knew you. I don't even know you, man. You mean you're a fiction writer? Well, anyway, all I know is that he works with me. I'm a director of one of our programs here, and he's one of my TAs, and he's always reading books of poems, and he's always writing poetry and thinking about poetry. And so we got to talking one day, and Ocean Vuong came up, who is just a phenomenon. This young poet, his very first book has just got so much attention, and like I said, it's actually a bestseller. Have you ever heard of a poetry book that's a bestseller? And you were telling me that you liked his poetry.
Yes, I discovered him by chance, and I absolutely loved him.
And so we just started talking about Ocean, and so he wanted to join me in the studio today. Welcome to the studios, Aldo, and he helps us here on the radio show. So thank you, Aldo. All right, stick around, and we're going to talk to Ocean Vuong. Ocean Vuong, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hello, glad to be here.
We're talking to you from your home in New York City.
Yes.
I got to say, when I looked up your book, when I did my research, this is called by Amazon a bestseller. And I remember several months ago, I think it was Eduardo Corral posted something on Facebook about how your book is just, they can't keep it on the shelves. I mean, it sells so well. If there is such a thing as a poetry bestseller, this is it. Did that surprise you that there would be so much interest in your book of poems?
Oh my God. I mean, surprise is the best word I have for it, but really it was just absolute shock because, to be honest, you know, like any other first book poet, especially as a poet, I was just grateful for an ISBN,
you know? Right.
And mostly I was just really happy to have something to show my mom, you know, like,
right.
At first I didn't want to have even a photo or anything on the back, but, you know, I thought about my mother who can't read, and I know that she will have the book, as she does now, under her desk at the nail salon where she works.
Oh, she's still at the nail salon.
Yeah, and she shows it to her clients, you know, and her customers who are friends of her, and she always points to the photo, you know, because she couldn't read the words. So I knew I had to have a picture in the back. But mostly I was just happy to have a book in the world and to have something I was proud of and to show my mom that, you know, this very abstract work that I do is now physically realized in a book with my face on it, with my name on it.
So the picture on the cover, there are two women and a young kid. Is that your grandma and your mother and you?
Yes, yes. That's my mother, me, and my aunt.
Oh, your aunt.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you didn't have any idea that it was going to be as successful. And I got to tell the listeners something. Like I said, Amazon calls this bestseller, and your numbers are incredible. Not that poetry is about numbers. We won't talk about this for long, but you had a first book out, and it's from Sibling Rivalry Press, and it's out of print, but you can still buy a copy of it on Amazon for $1,700.
You know, a friend sent me that link a while back. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was some sort of scam, you know. I don't know. It was a chapbook, you know. It was only about
40 pages.
It was just everything I was writing. And even that was a surprise. I was reading at a funeral, and the editor happened to be in the audience. A mutual friend of ours passed away, and I wasn't publishing anything really. But I was reading at a funeral, and he was starting this press, and he said, send me a book. He said, do you have a book? And, you know, like any young poet, I didn't have a book. But when someone says, do you have one? You say, yes.
Yes, absolutely.
So I went home and put it together and worked on it.
And then they wanted to publish it. I've heard that story before. I've heard it with Marcus Wicker, actually. I was doing a reading with him a couple of months ago, and he was saying that that's how he got his press. And I thought Keith Leonard also said that he was at a reading, and he read, and they said, send us a book, and that's how he got published. But I've never heard it being set at a funeral.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a sad and joyous moment, too, yeah.
Right. And your book, Night Sky with Exit Wounds, has been translated, or much of your work, I should say, I don't know if it's the entire book, has been translated into Bulgarian, Arabic, Hindi, Spanish. Now, I get the Spanish, but the Arabic and Hindi, do you have those copies? And what does it feel like to, I'm assuming you don't read Arabic, maybe you do, and Hindi, but what does it feel like to look at your poetry in a language with characters that perhaps are strange to you?
I mean, you know, we talk about success and we're talking about numbers in poetry, but really that was the most palpable moment of success to me, which that my language was truly borderless, where that it could be, if there were any borders, it could be dismantled and transferred from one people, one culture to another, one tongue to another, so that, you know, to have my work in someone else's mother tongue, you know, a work that in English is not even my own mother tongue, seems the closest thing to what I ever dreamed as a writer, you know, away from publication or accolades or sales. You know, that was, to me, the magical moment to me, you know.
Yeah, you know, I love the story about how you got your name. I found it, I forget where exactly, but your mother, or was it your grandmother, was trying to say the word beach?
Yeah, my mom, yeah.
Your mom, and she pronounced it in a way that made it sound kind of, you know, like she wasn't saying beach, but was saying
a
derogatory term. But what I really liked about that story is your reflection afterwards, where you say that the word, your name being ocean, again, you know, just for the listeners, your mother tried to say beach in the nail salon, and the women in the salon just says, well, why don't you just say ocean? And maybe it's easier for you to pronounce so you don't cuss.
Yeah.
And she loved the sound of it. She changed your name. She called you Ocean. But I love your reflection about how ocean is something that touches both Vietnam and the United States.
Yeah, that was her, you know, like she saw it later on. We were in the welfare department in Hartford, and she saw a map, and she saw the word ocean. She couldn't read it, but she knew it indicated the Pacific Ocean, and she saw it finally. It was like the first time, you know, I think she was only 20, 22, and it was the first time she saw a whole map of the world in that office, and she saw, oh, there's Vietnam. And I remember, you know, she was so surprised of how small it was, because if you're a person, you live in one country or another, your whole world is filled with that country, regardless of how big or small that country is. And so she did not see the perspective, and she saw that it touched both sides. And that's why I always say that, you know, my family are full of poets before me. They just never wrote.
Right.
But their minds and their imaginations were already so poetic, so I'm just finally writing things down.
Yeah, and that's another thing about your biography that I find very interesting, that your family, the people you grew up around, were functionally illiterate, yet at the same time, you grew up around a lot of poetry, especially from your grandmother.
Yeah, I think the illiteracy freed them. You know, I'm an advocate for literacy always, but, you know, because they couldn't, the restrictions forced their imagination to come up with their own answers, their own mythologies, you know, like, there was the time where I was traveling in a plane with my mom for the first time, and we encountered turbulence. And I must have been only 6 or 7. And it was very scary as a child. You know, the turbulence could be quite rough. And I turned to her, and I said, Mom, what's happening, you know? And she, you know, in retrospect, I realized she probably didn't know either, but she looked out the window, and she just said, you know, when we go this high, the clouds, they turn to stones. And the plane is just moving through stones right now, but that's normal. When you go through stones, it's rocky, and then we'll clear up. And when she said that, I looked out at the clouds, the gray, boulderous clouds, and I said, oh, that makes sense. And I wasn't worried anymore.
Wow, that's a beautiful story. I know sometimes you, like a line may occur to you, or maybe a syntactical unit might occur to you, and you hold it for a long time, and it becomes a poem even before you write it down. Did that one ever become a poem?
I'm working on a series of essays now involving that, and the imagination unbounded by language, and I'm just trying to see where it goes, but I've been thinking about that a lot recently.
I was listening recently to an interview with Julio Cortázar, and he was saying that sometimes he would write, or he'd have a first line, and he would think it's a poem, and then he would just sit down and follow the language, and it would end up a story. And then it would happen sometimes that he thought he was going to write a story, but it would end up a poem. Does that happen to you?
Absolutely. And I mean, that's the best part. If I know it, why bother? You know, if I know what's going to happen, why bother? I like to understand the world that I'm entering. Uh-huh. And so I have it in mind. I have a world in mind, a scene. Uh-huh. But that's usually about it. And I carry that scene for a while. But the actual discoveries, where we go, the meaning, the surprises, the images, that happens in the moment. Similar to jazz, you know, the novelist Haruki Murakami, he would write these 500, 900 page books. But he said, I start off with a title, maybe a scene, and I just keep going until it's done.
Right.
I feel that's similar.
Right, yeah. And what is your impulse to write a poem, and how does it differ from your impulse to write to begin with?
My first impulse was preservation. I didn't know someone like me could be a poet. You know, it's silly, but as an immigrant living in working class background, everything in your life is dictated by official thresholds. You know, everything has to be stamped, you have to get approved and everything. And so I thought to be a poet, you need like some sort of approval, or you need to be preordained by the government or something. I just didn't think I had the papers to be a poet. It sounds so silly, but that's how I was thinking. And so I didn't think I could publish or anything. I just wrote my grandmother's poems down and the stuff that she recited, because they couldn't write. And so I thought, well, writing was an act of preservation to me. And so first and foremost, that's what it was. And I think similarly, even now, it is an act of preservation of the DNA of the personhood, the DNA of the mind.
Right.
And yeah, to me, it's like the, you know, we have a fingerprint. We press our fingerprint down on ink and paper, and that preserves is their idiosyncratic self given to us by our parents. But how do we press down the idiosyncratic nature, the joys, the fears, the terrors, the obsessions that make a singular person? Like when we say, I love someone, we don't simply say the name or the face. We say all the things that encompass the personality. And I think writing, in a similar way, pressing down our thumbprint of ourselves.
Wow, yeah, that's very well stated. And it kind of reminds me of one of your poems where you talk about your grandmother who was with a serviceman. And essentially the poem is saying that there were no bombs, there was no family. And basically the bombs, as horrible as they were, the war as horrible as it was, you're a product of that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm grappling with that idea, you know, and I'm starting to understand it more. And, you know, on its surface, it seems that we were born and we have our lives, my mother and I, because of war. But I'm starting to think that we have our lives despite the war.
Mm-hmm.
Even in that moment, the act of lovemaking is a choice. It's not always a choice that is entertained and enacted. But in that case, it was. In the middle of that, there was beauty, and in that beauty, there was life.
Wow. I'm talking to Ocean Vuong, author of Night Sky with Exit Wounds. And I was curious about your collection of essays. I'm sure that's going to be quite anticipated once people start hearing more about it. You had this idea that I can't get out of my mind. Every time I go to New York, I'm going to think of fire escapes, and I'm going to notice these fire escapes. Can you tell us a little bit about that, what occurred to you as you just, you know, the omnipresent fire escapes all over the city, and how it made its way into an essay?
Well, you know, I grew up in Hartford, and there were very few fire escapes, believe it or not. And I worked in tobacco fields in the Connecticut River Valley, so it was in the country. It's hard to imagine. You know, we think of Connecticut, we think of the little part of Danbury where all the rich people live.
Right.
But most of Connecticut is very diverse with multiple cultures and landscapes. And so I lived in the city, but I worked in the country. And I didn't see fire escapes this robust and this richly until I went to the city, to New York. And I saw people decorating them. And I was just enamored of the way they existed, these symbols of danger. It was just such an honest recognition of where life fails.
Right.
And yet also the hope that we might live, that we have prepared for an escape route. And that we pushed it outside, you know, that it's always that we don't want to think about danger, but we prepared for it. And I thought it was quite a lovely way to think about writing and poetry.
Right.
And to me, the poem at its best is a fire escape. We don't recite it at the grocery store or in line at the cafe. People think we're crazy. And yet, when we read it on our own terms, it becomes just as necessary as those steel architectures in which we might save our lives.
Wow, that's beautiful. How did you know, though, that it needed to be an essay and not a poem?
I didn't. You know, I wrote an essay about my uncle and his death, and I always thought about it, and I was taking these walks, you know, trying to figure it out. I always take these walks to figure out my thoughts.
Well, you're in a good city for that.
Yeah. So I just kept on looking at them closer and closer. And I was so heartened by the way people decorated them. You know, like, here's this thing that we will meet, perhaps our end. And yet people have turned them into balconies, put cafe tables, they decorated with flowers, lights, string lights. And I just thought it was this very beautiful, hopeful moment of human interaction with danger.
Luis Urrea came out with a book about 10 years ago that had just been reissued by the University of Arizona Press, and it's essentially a diary of his travels. And
Wow. And
he says, walking equals writing. Would you agree with that? Would you consider your walking as really just part of your process?
Absolutely. I would even say just living. I mean, Yeah. If you have bad knees and you can't walk, just lay down.
Uh-huh.
As long as you cater to your obsession, if you are catering to it in your mind, that to me is work. That is work, too.
Wow.
You know, there are days that I don't write a single word, and yet the poem has developed because I have been thinking about it.
Yeah, it reminds me of Kafka in his diaries. He says that you don't need to leave your kitchen, and the world will reveal itself to you as you're just sitting there staring at a wall.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're a slow writer or a fast writer?
Yeah, very slow. Very slow. The writing is the last part. There's an ancient Chinese philosophy, yin and yang, and the idea that I was really kindred to me was that yin is this collective, passive mode where you just simply collect the data of the world, where you receive it and encompass it without judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And yang is like the final moment of execution. And instead of fishing with your bare hands and lunging and being exhausted, you cast the net wide as you can. And then when it's finally time to bring the net up, you decide what to do with the fish. And that's the yang moment. And to me, that's writing. That's
Wow. Final
decision.
That's an interesting process. I don't think a lot of people think of writing that way. They think of writing as, you know, you have to do it every day if you want to get stuff good. Was it hard for you to produce work when you were, I assume that you have an MFA. Was it hard for you to produce work when that's your writing process?
Yeah, there was a lot of, you know, shame involved because I thought I was a fraud. You know, I thought, okay, if everybody else is writing so hard, you know, I couldn't do it. I was so distracted by my writing because, like, I didn't think about anything. My ideas were not fleshed out, and here I am forcing this thing out, and I felt like it was like giving birth every day. You know, you can't do that. It takes 9 months, you know. It was nurturing. I felt like a fraud. I said, okay, you know, I'm not cut out for this, I guess, you know. So I actually stopped for a while. But this is way before my MFA. I got my MFA. The book was accepted the first day of my MFA. And so,
oh, my.
It was kind of strange where I just edited the book throughout my MFA. And my teachers were very kind, and they knew the situation, so they didn't force me to to crank out poems so much. You know, they were very lenient with that, and I was very grateful for them.
Well, if you keep these, again, I don't know how to phrase it, the syntactic unit or images or thoughts, and you allow the poem to grow over time as you think about it more, as you follow the language more, does that mean that when you actually sit down and write it, when you, Paco Taibo calls butt time, you know, where you're sitting in front of your piece of paper or your computer, is the first draft pretty much near where it's going to be?
No. Because then there's the realities of syntax, pressure, momentum, clauses. And of course, you can't hold all that in your head unless you're like a computer, you know. So I think of it as the work before that is capturing the essence, the duende, as Lorca would call it. And, you know, you have to nurture duende. That's the hardest part, because if you execute a pristine work of literature without the duende, then you just have, you know, a very well-crafted container.
Right.
And boxes are very great, but if there's nothing inside the box, then the box is useless. And so I think about the duende a lot and how to nurture that.
Yeah, something has to push on the box from the inside in order for you to, like, feel a little bit of tension about it and worry about what's in that box.
Yeah.
We're running out of time, but I wonder if you'd be willing to read one of your poems from Night Sky with Exit Wounds.
Yeah, sure.
I have a TA in the studio today. His name's Aldo Amparan, and he is a big fan of your work. And maybe we can let him choose.
Yeah. What do you think, Aldo?
Oh, God. Like, there's so many that I love.
How did you find Ocean Vuong?
Just, I got it out of a whim on Amazon, so.
Oh.
And just loved it from the beginning. I teach an intro course for undergrad here in the university, and one of the poems that I choose to teach was Prayer for the Newly Damned.
Oh, beautiful. Okay, yeah. That's great. I haven't read that in a long time. It's one of the oldest poems.
Sweet.
Okay. Prayer for the Newly Damned. Dearest Father, forgive me, for I have seen behind the wooden fence a field lit with summer, a man pressing a shank to another man's throat, steel turning to light on sweat-slick neck. Forgive me for not twisting this tongue into the shape of your name, for thinking this must be how every prayer begins. The word please, cleaving the wind into fragments, into what a boy hears in his need to know how pain blesses the body back to its center. The hour suddenly stilled. The man, his lips pressed to black boot. Am I wrong to love those eyes? To see something so clear and blue, beg to remain clear and blue? Did my cheek twitch when the wet shadow bloomed from his crotch and trickled into ochre dirt? How quickly the blade becomes you. But let me begin again. There's a boy kneeling in a house with every door kicked open to summer. There's a question corroding his tongue, a knife touching your finger lodged inside the throat. Dearest Father, what becomes of the boy, no longer a boy? Please, what becomes of the shepherd when the sheep are cannibals?
That was Ocean Vuong reading from his book, Night Sky with Exit Wounds. I love the way you read. I remember when Lee Young Lee came out with Behind My Eyes, he included a CD of him reading some of the poems. Would you ever consider doing that?
Yeah, I never thought of it, but yeah, I think it'll be a nice idea.
Reading your poems is one experience. Hearing you reading it is another experience. And
Thank you.
No, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. It's a beautiful book, and we wish you the best of luck on that collection of essays. I can't wait to get my hands on that. When's that coming out?
Oh, I don't know. I'm in the messy tip stage.
Well, I love that you're in no hurry to get another book out. I admire that. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Daniel, and thank you for the extraordinary work you've been doing there.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. I'd like to thank our guest, Ocean Vong, for joining us on Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank our engineer, Felipe Talavera, and, of course, Aldo Amparan. Join us every week on Words on a Wire. Have a great week.